Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today. My guest is author, shamanic healer, and life coach, Sarah Bamford Seidelman, and we're here to discuss her very first novel, Where the Deer Dream, a coming-of-age adventure in spirit. Sarah is the author of a number of different books, but this is her first venture into fiction, which also includes some psychedelic healing for an 18-year-old character, the main character of the story. We're going to talk all about her career, her life, how she got into shamanism and plant medicines, and just talking about the novel and all different kinds of things related to that. So I'm recording this rather early because it's a holiday week here in the United States. So if anybody has made a contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast over the past week, I do not know about it at this point that I am recording this and making it available. So I'll get to thanking you in the next podcast episode. Of course, if you would like to support this podcast, your support is greatly appreciated. It's quite easy. Just stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net. You can use the PayPal link that is at the top right of the page. Or, as I like to say, even better, come on over to my Patreon page, for which there is also a link at the top right of my personal webpage, and become a monthly supporter and gain access to special gifts and services and all kinds of great things. If you join over at Patreon, that's patreon.com/martinwball. And next week, we'll be getting back into a couple more chapters from Orbi's Vision, and then be having an interview with a 5-MeO DMT provider and practitioner up in Canada, Magda. She's going to be next up on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to that. She actually works with Daniel Schmidt over there at the Awakening the World Initiative and the Samadhi Institute. So I thought it'd be a nice tie-in to bring the person who is working with 5-MeO up there on those retreats for an interview here on the podcast. So we have that to look forward to. Plus, I got a big stack of books from authors to be interviewed. So got a lot of reading ahead of me, and then we'll have more interviews. So busy, busy, busy. Anyway, hope you had a good holiday week or weekend if you celebrate Thanksgiving and Indigenous Peoples Day in the United States. And just preemptively, I'll say thank you for the birthday wishes, because I'm sure some of you out there listening wished me a happy birthday on Friday. As you know, Facebook tells everybody when it's your birthday. So that probably happened. I'm just guessing that that happened. So I'm just saying thank you preemptively. So here's my talk with Sarah. She joined me from Duluth, Minnesota. Over there in the Midwest, yeah, but she doesn't sound like she's from Minnesota with my stereotypical Fargo accent. Well, it's Minnesota accent. Yeah, Fargo. It's a great, I love the Coen brothers. We're going to be talking about her book, Where the Deer Dream, which has just been released. And so this is probably her very first interview about her new book. So that's cool, yeah? So here she is. Enjoy. Catch you next week here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. And so what I like to do is just kind of start to get to know my guest and get a little bit about your background. And I've got your website up here, Follow Your Feel Good. I like that name.
Thank you.
And obviously you've been doing a lot of other things prior to writing this novel. And for the listeners out there, we're going to be talking about Where the Deer Dream, a coming of age adventure in spirit. And I think this is pretty new, is it not? How long has this been out now?
It is not even out yet. It's coming out the day after Thanksgiving.
Well, fantastic, because then this interview will be out the following Monday. So that'll be just perfect to help promote it. And then day after Thanksgiving, that's actually my birthday.
What? That's crazy. I love it.
Yeah. Going to be 49. Getting up there.
Awesome. Well, I've got you beat by like 5 years. So you're just but a young pup.
Yeah, I feel the same way about anybody who's younger these days. Like, especially like people that I know that like turning 30, and I'm thinking like, oh, my goodness, you've just entered adulthood.
Yeah, 30 seems young.
Yeah, doesn't it? Well, Sarah, let's get a little bit of your background. I think you're in Duluth now.
Yep. Yep. And I practiced medicine for 20 years, not all of it in Duluth, but the vast majority of it in Duluth. And I was kind of what I like to describe myself as like a paid professional disease hunter, because I was a pathologist. So I spent most of my days staring into a microscope, looking at all the biopsies, like, you know, so skin biopsies, bone marrow biopsies. If you had a lung taken out, whatever it was, like it went across my desk and went through under my microscope. And I was sort of the doctor who would tell your doctor, your surgeon, your oncologist, your dermatologist, what was going on with you, if there was any disease present there. And I loved that. I was passionate about it for years. And then I started getting like less enchanted by it. And I started being curious about what makes people well. And I eventually like hired a life coach. She was like, encouraged me to like, you know, explore things I liked. And anyway, I finally took a sabbatical to kind of really spend some time exploring what makes people well and what makes people feel good, you know, hence the website.
Follow your feel good. Yeah.
Yeah. And during that time that I had off, I sort of stumbled into this old ancient idea that, you know, the animals, the wild animals that cross our paths may have messages for us, which at the time I can just tell you sounded completely bananas. I was like, what? I'm like, how could that be? Like, you know, I was very deeply rooted in the scientific community and, you know, fully logical, you know, it was sort of my bend. But at the same time, I was also quite desperate. I was in the dark woods of the hero's journey. You know, I just was like, what the hell is going on with me? I got to go back to work, but yet I do not want to go back to work. Mm. And so I just started paying attention to the animals that were crossing my path. I thought, well, I'm just going to give this a try. And lo and behold, I found it to be quite helpful. And the first, I call them beasties now, because they kind of, beasties sort of covers everything from like a dragonfly up to something more mythical, like a Pegasus or something. I stumbled into this taxidermied walrus in a little shop in our downtown. And I was, you know, you're supposed to pay attention to what animals are really grabbing your attention. And I'm like, well, this walrus has got my attention. If you've ever seen a walrus, most of us haven't seen one in real life. But anyway, this one had like, I don't know, the tusks were like 3 feet long. It just was gigantic. It was very arresting. And so I was like, okay, Mr. Walrus, you've got my attention. Like, I feel like you've got a message for me. And the walrus wasn't saying much. So I was like, oh, okay. So I went back to visit a couple times, but I was like trying to understand. So I began to learn more about walruses. And one of the things I noticed as I was watching YouTube footage of them on the beach is that they're extremely relaxed. I mean, if you've ever watched a walrus on a beach, they're like, you know, very surrender to the earth. They're like, you know, they're not, you can tell they're not hepped up on anxiety. Like, are we going to run out of clams or something? They're just very walrusy. Like, they're just being themselves. And then the other thing I learned about them is that they're apex predators. So they don't really have any competition save man. And occasionally they will tangle with a polar bear, but it's very uncommon, because it usually means like one or both of them are going to die. So I put those two things together and I was like, well, maybe the walrus is trying to, you know, tell me that should I be able to find a way to get comfortable in my own skin and just manage to be myself, maybe I too would have no competition should I choose a different field like writing or life coaching or just anything. I mean, I was just wide open at that point about what the heck am I supposed to be doing with my life if it's not this career. And that really gave me a lot of encouragement. And eventually I went on a shamanic journey. And I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with what that is, but you essentially use the drum to beat a particular beat. I've got my drum right here. I can pound it for you I won't do that. I don't know how that would sound on the podcast. But I went on a journey to try to connect with what, you know, many people call a power animal or a spirit animal. And I like to call them core beasties, again, because beastie is just a wonderful, fun term, and core because of the core of you. And that day I encountered this mother bear, and she just rubbed my back and she was so loving. And I remember just crying, and she's like, you know, where you're going, you know, it's not that far. And it was sort of down a hill. She showed me this like sloped hill. It was like downhill. I'm like, well, at least it's downhill. It's like climb Mount Everest or something. And when I came back from that journey, I just felt this like absolute, like that kind of love that, I mean, I was a loved child very much, but it was kind of this otherworldly love. And it was so encouraging and inspiring. I tried to understand it with my mind and I really couldn't. So I finally just decided I'm going to keep visiting this bear because I mean, I don't have any better ideas. And she's really, it helped me feel better. And so I continued to visit her, and that led to me, you know, fully stumbling onto the shamanic path of spirit, you know, connecting with nature. Yeah, so that's kind of a little bit. And eventually I got the courage to fully leave. I did go back to work part-time for a while, but eventually left medicine fully about 2 years later. Another spirit animal encouraged me to throw all my, you know, my medical, like my, what do you call those, diplomas into the, mm-hmm. into the river in the spirit world. She was like, where you're going, you don't need any of this. And by then I, you know, really had begun to trust them because they had been helping me a lot to understand my life and to heal kind of from, you know, just life, I think, in general. So.
Okay. Well, I have a couple questions I'd like to get back to you on. But first, if you wouldn't mind, I'll share a quick bear story.
Please.
So where I live, there is an undeveloped lot that's actually just right behind my house, right over there. And it's apparently something of a wildlife corridor. There's like an old rancher who sort of lives up the hill, and he likes to keep it for, you know, the wild animals. And so he doesn't want to like sell it and like develop a house right there. But it's a place that could have a house, but there is no house. So it's just kind of, we've got some cedar trees and oak trees and a few other pine trees. So it's just a little green woodland hill. And so every day there's deer back and forth. And actually my dog is trying to get out right now because she probably saw a deer and she wants to go bark at them. And like turkeys are on the other side of this fence. We have this wire mesh fence with these tall 8-foot wooden poles. So anyway, last week, maybe it's exactly a week ago, might have been Monday or Tuesday, I forget which night it was. But anyway, I was in bed and I heard this crunching sound coming from outside. And I immediately thought, that's my bird feeder. Like, oh, I think I got a bear. And sure enough, I got up and the bird feeder is just like 10 feet away from where I'm sitting, like right now. And there's this big old bear has completely destroyed my bird feeders, you know, these little plastic containers. Because, you know, it's got like the peanuts mixed in. And I guess the bears like really love the peanuts. So he's just sitting there, and I have a sliding glass door right over here. And so I couldn't miss the opportunity. So I turned on all the lights and I grabbed my camera and I put the right lens on and I took some photos of it. And then it was just sitting there. It's just like looking at me like, what? What's the problem? I'm eating your bird seed. So I had to go out. You know, I put some pants on and I went out. And I was like, get out of here, bear. This is not your place. And then it ran, you know, 20 feet and climbed up one of these poles to the fence. And then it just sat there looking at me. And this is like, aren't you going to go back to bed so I can finish off that bird seed? But then, you know, I went further out and said, get out of here, bear. And it ran down the other side and ran away. But that was my closest bear encounter to date. Wow. I mean, it was just like 10 feet away. And it did not care when I opened up the door. So we have a lot of, you know, urban animals around here.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my recent bear story. But I just wanted to ask you, because you mentioned, you know, having worked in medicine and then decided to leave that. Just looking at your little biography on the back of Where the Deer Dream, it does mention that it says fourth generation physician. So just curious about that background and kind of putting it in that context of how monumental it must have been for you to have left that field and that world, if that was your family, and maybe it was even the expectation that, yeah, Sarah, you're going to be a physician too. And so then making that choice for yourself is a really big one. So,
yeah, for sure. I think, it for sure threw my parents for a loop. My mom in particular, I think, it, when you've got a kid who becomes a doctor, it's probably a nice feeling to go, yes, my child's a doctor, you know, like it. I think she enjoyed that. And then it's maybe not so thrilling when they say, what does your kid do? And you're like, they're a life coach. She maybe didn't understand that. But all in all, they were supportive. I think it was hard to leave. There was a lot of, I think when I was in that sabbatical time, I really questioned like my own sanity. I started having some really interesting experiences with nature that summer. I was just walking a lot alone and for hours on end. And I remember sitting in this marsh and these cattails were kind of blowing. And then I really got the distinct impression that the wind and the cattails were blowing and moving just for me, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of communicate with me. And that was really odd. I remember thinking, okay, I'm either A, going insane, which was something pretty common in my family as well. We had a lot of like bipolar and, some other things, you know, psychiatric things in our family. And so I did have that concern. And I remember thinking, gosh, like, am I the only one? I mean, all the other doctors seem to be able to keep going. And I was like, you know, I felt very alone in that. Mm-hmm. I think now there's a lot of physicians feeling disenfranchised, you know, maybe not as satisfied with what they're doing, but yeah, but I had a lot of support for it. Not a lot of people understood it, I don't think, that move. They were like, wow, you know, you're leaving all that behind. And certainly there's more prestige again, when people ask you what you do. I remember being like, people are like, what do you do now? And I'm like, you know, for a long time, I didn't really have an answer for what I did. I was like, I'm kind of walking in the woods right now and listening to animals, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the decision brought you more personal peace and happiness.
Absolutely. I mean, now I just pinch myself, like what I get to do and the kind of work that I get to do is just such a blessing. And I'm so glad. And yet I had to go through what I had to go through. And, you know, my path really started back in medical school. I share this story in one of my other books that I had a particular patient who was dying. And during that rotation, I remember thinking, we're not helping this person. Like, we need to be doing something that we're not doing for her. We, you know, we would tell her every day, well, gosh, she had her platelets, the part of your blood that helps you to have blood clots and keeps you from bleeding to death, were very, very low. And we couldn't seem to get them to go any higher. And she was, you know, mid-30s. It was very poignant. She had little kids. And I remember the morning she died, my upper resident and my just like got this page running up the stairs one morning, and we both sat down in the stairwell and just cried, because it was like, I think it was just like, it was just so horrible. We just felt so bad that we couldn't do anything. And I think I was crying for like the idea that, well, was anybody even with her when she died? Did anybody talk to her about the fact she was dying? So things like that happened. And I remember thinking, that's why I ended up going into pathology. Cause I was like, I don't know how to help people like that. I have no idea, but I know there's something we're supposed to be doing that we're missing. And years later, you know, now, you know, basically almost 20 years later, I finally, you know, through the path of shamanism and spirit, realized what I was really longing to do is to help people at the level of the soul, you know, and that's the work I do now. And I sort of had a full circle moment a few years into that sabbatical, where I was sat with a dying person and helped them with some spiritual healing. And it was like, oh yeah, this is what I was looking for, you know, 20 years ago, but it wasn't the right timing.
Yeah.
So.
So you do mention going out into the woods, and so you're in Duluth, Minnesota. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yep.
So I've never been over to that area of the world, and I'm a big naturalist. I'm a big nature photographer. I'm always interested in, as you say, what local beasties there are. So, yeah, the local environment there. I'm very curious to hear about it.
Incredible. I mean, we have Lake Superior, which is, and it's sort of like, Duluth is built on a hill, so we call it, it's called the Little San Francisco of the Midwest. So it's built on a big granite hill and overlooking the lake, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. And then we have like boreal forests, so it's a lot of white pines, cedar, birch, beautiful rivers, like the most incredible rivers. I mean, it's just, and our city has been really wonderful. We have so many natural wild spaces to wander in all the neighborhoods, so it's a really special place. You should come visit sometime, Mark. Well, Duluth, you should come visit. It's absolutely, I think Outside Magazine called it like one of the top places to live in the country now. It's got like hundreds of miles of mountain biking trails. And I mean, it's just, it's a wildlife lover's paradise. But the winter is long, which makes it for good book writing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing about book writing, is you need uninterrupted time alone.
And yes.
Time to think, and time to write. And especially time to think, I find as a writer, that I saw this one, I don't know if it was a comic, I don't know what it was, but it might've just been a meme on the internet, but it was some guy who was lying on the floor, and like his wife or his partner comes in and she's like, what are you doing? You're just lazing around. He's like, I'm writing. Like, what do you mean I'm writing? He's like, I'm thinking.
About writing.
Yeah, and I thought that was really great because actually a lot of it is just kind of sitting around and thinking and getting your thoughts straight about what you want to write. So that sounds like a good segue to get into writing. Where the Deer Dream, this is your first novel, but you have a number of books. So where did you start with your own writing career?
Yeah, so that, well, I told you about that animal fascination and the fascination with messages. Hmm. And that summer I started a podcast. This was like 12 years ago and there were very few podcasts. And we had a call-in one, which was really fun. And I did that for like 35 episodes. And that was my education in, you know, wild animals, spirit animal messages. I mean, it was incredible. We had people call in and tell the most magical stories. And so the first book I wrote was called What the Walrus Knows. And it was just really a kind of a guide, a gentle sort of friendly guide for starting to understand how wild animals can come to us and teach us and help us out when we're struggling as humans. And then eventually I turned that into, Set for Sounds True, I did a book called The Book of Beasties, which is sort of an encyclopedic work of, yeah, you can look up 150 animals in there and find out what they might be trying to share with you, you know, as they cross your path or come through your dreams or, you know, so that was a really fun project to work on. And I wrote a memoir called Swimming with Elephants, which is all about my path from leaving medicine to stepping onto the path of shamanism. And spirit and I had four kids, you know, my husband, we're married, we had four kids. I mean, so it's like, you know, you take the whole family along and they're all teenagers. I mean, there was a lot of drama that went along with all this, you know, this change wasn't just not just a little thing. It was a big thing because we had to, you know, downsize, we had to move into a different neighborhood. I mean, all kinds of things changed for us in the best way, but, you know, challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe with this transition into being a writer and a life coach that maybe you ended up with more time for your family.
For sure. And I think that was a big thing that, you know, I told you I was crying with that, in that first journey with my bear. I mean, I used to visit her and just cry and cry and cry. And I think a lot of it was the grief of having four children and having spent hours away from, I mean, days and my husband and I still cringe. I mean, they would go to daycare for 10, 11 hours a day. I mean, it just... there's something about that, and this may not be for everybody, but for me anyway, it was just really hard to be a good doctor and to be a good mom, you know, and not to mention daughter, parent, you know, everything else.
Yeah, well, I can really identify with that at this point, I'm pretty much exclusively self-employed, which means that I don't make a lot of money, but I do get to spend just tons of time with my youngest son, Jaden, who's 8 and a half, and, you know, kind of in line with what we're talking about here, all he wants to do is be out in nature, like, all the time. I mean, as soon as he gets home from school, he's like, so, Dad, what adventure are we going on today? What animals are we going to go look for? Do you think we'll find some eagles today? And, you know, if he didn't have to go to school, he would just want to do that, like, all the time. And I've really thought about how, for so many parents, that... as you say, their kids are in daycare or they're in school and then you're busy at work. And really, it's this bizarre situation where we live in the society where parents actually only spend a couple or maybe only one or two like really meaningful hours with their kids on any given day. And the majority of the time, the kids are under somebody else's care and we don't actually get to spend real time with them. And I think it's really a tragedy because, I mean, I just cherish the time that I have with Jaden so much. It's just so wonderful to have a little kid who's just, all he wants to do is see lizards and snakes and birds and climb on rocks and go jump in a lake or, you know, climb a mountain. It's just wonderful.
That is so wonderful. That's fabulous. And I'm so glad you get to do that. Yeah, it was a real gift for me because, yeah, I got to hang out with my kids and yeah, I can just be there for them, but also feel like I'm getting to explore everything I want to explore professionally too. So it's, yes, making lots less money but the riches that have nothing to do with money, as you know, are like so incredible. And that may sound, Pollyanna, but hey, if you've never watched the movie on Pollyanna on BBC, check it out. It's pretty legit.
And I do see a painting in the background. Is this yours?
Yeah, Yeah, I've been, like, the last couple of years, I've really started getting into making more art. And and that's been really, you know, I guess the self-expression started with the writing, and then it just sort of started to ooze into many other things. And really enjoying that.
Yeah, it's a special satisfaction, isn't it? I mean, it's so different. I mean, I'm sure that you felt a certain sense of satisfaction from doing the lab work, that, you know, there's the investigation, there's the determination, there's the, okay, we've identified, and then passing on that knowledge that you know is going to be helpful to someone. So I'm sure there's a satisfaction there, but that's very different from the creative outlet, the creative expression. So how has that change and shift for you, and how has that changed your appreciation just for being you?
Yeah, I think in medicine, I always felt like, well, I'm being of service. You know, how can I make this report as salient and helpful to them as I can? How can I do my best work, you know? And how can I bring joy to what can be a tough place to be, the hospital, wherever I can? And then as I moved into writing and coaching, I guess it was similar. I mean, always out of service. And I guess what I love about art is when I'm making art, I'm not thinking about being of service. I'm just making it for the fun of it, for the heck of it. And it's such a free, especially when I just like put on some music that I like and I just let myself, like, let the painting paint itself, you know, and I just become the conduit. That's really fun for me and really joyful. And then they really speak to me, like the paint. It's like this cat that I've got behind me. When I come into the office every day, it's like, whoa.
Yeah, it's looking at me.
You know, it's kind of this, you get a real feeling from them. And that's really special. I have this wonderful teacher, Aviva Gold. Anybody who wants to, she does these wonderful workshops in Arizona. And she has a great book called Painting from the Source. And she really helps people to try, you know, to learn how to become those conduits, you know, to set up sacred space and let the painting come through you that wants to be painted, which is a really, you know, neat process. Kind of frightening, but then also really freeing once you let it happen.
Yeah. So are you mostly painting animals, or do you get into other subject matter?
I really like painting abstracts, but for this, actually in this last month, I've been doing a dieta. I don't know if you guys talk about dietas on this podcast, but a dieta with the plant Wild Rose. And last year when I did a dieta with them, it was like this wildcat came through, and this year same. It's like, so that just seems to be what Rose wants to share with me. So yeah, but usually I do more abstracts. Yeah. So figurative is not I'm not necessarily skillful at it, but I just like the feeling of doing it.
Cool. Well, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the life coaching, and I think it's significant that you're kind of coming from the medical background, the professional background, and then having made the decision to really make a major life change for yourself. I think that is something that, you know, in a sense qualifies you as a life coach. Something that I've seen about, so where I live in Ashland, there's a lot of people who sell themselves as life coaches. And honestly, with a lot of them, I've seen that they've never really done anything. And then they become a life coach to help people find their passion or whatever. But I've kind of felt like, well, maybe you haven't hit your success in whatever you were doing and then made the changes, and so that you don't necessarily have a before and after perspective. So I'm wondering, how do you feel that helps you be a life coach, having made this big transition within your own life into a very different mode of operation and a very different mode of being? Is that what you bring to your life coaching?
Yeah, I would say that's a huge part of it, is like, I have so much compassion for people who are going, I like to think of it in terms of the hero's journey. That's kind of the way I like looking at big. So you get this catalytic event, whether it's, you know, you got divorced, you got fired, or COVID came, or, you know, some big thing that caused your identity to shatter. And then, you know, we sort of head into this place where, you know, it's like no man's land, and it is not fun. And it is, yeah. So I've been there. And so I have a lot of compassion. And I think a lot of people have, a lot of my clients have found me either through my story, swimming with elephants, and once they read the book, which is pretty vulnerable, and I really kind of lay all the cards out on the table, I think people are like, okay, this is somebody I can trust. She's been there, and somehow she crawled her way back out. And so I think that definitely leads a lot of, or lends me a lot of credibility. I also was diagnosed with ADHD, so that's another thing that I really lead with and talk about. You know, people who are creative and maybe have been labeled this, or maybe actually received the diagnosis from a physician or a caregiver. And I have a lot of compassion for those people. Those are my people. You know, I love people who are wildly creative and people who are, you know, we tend to be impulsive. We tend to be, kind of wacky, maybe maybe butting into conversations that, you know, there's all kinds of things. But I really have a lot of love for that group of people and wanting to see them thrive and to embrace themselves, because that was sort of the process I needed to go through myself. So,
yeah. Well, that's great that you were able to bring your life experience to it. And I do think the vulnerability that you mentioned, I think, is very significant, that sometimes, you know, we have life coaches that are sort of, I'm invincible and you can be invincible too, and that it doesn't necessarily really speak to the genuine human condition that we all experience suffering, and that we all are sort of on this quest for greater authenticity and greater, genuineness within our own heart and within our own behavior and within our own lives. And so being able to share, like, well, here have been my struggles and this is what I've done about it, I think that goes a long way to, as you say, adding credibility to someone and not just, here's how to be perfect.
And it's hard, you know, and not everybody needs to lead with their own hell and back story, you know, as I like to think about it. Like, a lot of people may be really excellent coaches, but you may not learn about their struggle because they choose not to make it, you know. But that doesn't mean they can't be an amazing coach. So, yeah, I mean, I just happen to be very public with mine for whatever reason. And again, that may just be because of my, I don't know why it is, but that's just the way it is. That's how I was hatched. So,
yeah. And I'm just curious, you say that you have four children and going through these big life transitions and changes. How have you found your relationship with your children has shifted along with it?
Yeah. So, you know, my sabbatical was about 10 years ago. So our kids were like, let's say they were like, I don't know, like 2 years up to 14, something like that. So we had the full range of, the littler ones benefited from me being around and didn't mind. And the 14-year-old was pretty bummed out when we moved from our big fancy house to a much smaller, less fancy house, and the pool table was gone and the Disney vacations were over. And my husband and I were ecstatic. Like, we could care less. We realized that, you know, we were kind of like the Buddhas. We realized, okay, the palace is not where it's at. We were just making this discovery that really what mattered was time. You know, having your freedom was more important. And then as they got older, you know, some of them started to realize what I was into, and that had consequences. Like, I remember there was a family who wouldn't let their kids come over to our house because they had heard that I was a shamanic practitioner, and that was something that was very against their religion, that they felt that was somehow maybe satanic, or I don't know, something like that. And that was really hard because we had to explain to our son, you know, it was just painful, you know. And I realized, wow, here we go. I remember trying to talk to the mom, and she was just like, nope, this is... but I think they have a lot of respect, and hopefully they have freedom, you know, to know that they can go, they can turn on a dime, they can choose whatever they like, and, you know, that we'll support them in that as long as it's legal. I'm just kidding. You know what I mean? That they've seen us taking these chances, and hopefully that'll encourage them, because kids do what they see what we do. They don't listen to what we say. You know, they watch us. I'm a firm believer in that. So,
yeah. Well, I think that's a good transition into talking about the book, because a huge portion of the book is the dynamic between Mira and her mom. And there's so many ways we can go with this. I just would share with you that something that really resonated with me in reading the book was that my own sister is Chilean, and she's adopted. And she's actually someone who has, you know, sadly kind of dropped off the radar, that many years ago she dropped her two kids off at my dad and stepmom's house, and she never came back. Kind of the identity of being an adopted child and being Latina in a white family, and also herself not speaking Spanish, and constantly people approaching her and trying to speak Spanish to her based on the way that she looked. Because in the book, Mira is adopted from Colombia, and yes. That a lot of those wounds and identity issues that I think my sister had that she never really addressed, and she kind of got into the quote wrong crowd with the wrong drugs, and mm-hmm. yeah, she's just kind of disappeared off the radar. I mean, I haven't seen my sister in maybe 15 years or more at this point. I have no idea where she is. And
so
that's something that kind of kept coming up for me in reading yeah. this story. So I've given away a little bit of the book. Let's just start with making the decision that you wanted to write a novel. Because again, you've published a number of other books, but this is your first novel, and that's a big change for a writer. And sometimes the audience comes along, and sometimes they don't, or sometimes it's a completely different audience. So, let's just start there with the decision or the idea that you wanted to write a novel.
Well, years ago, I had written this book called Born to Freak, A Salty Primer for Irrepressible Humans. And that was kind of my love letter to anybody who had been diagnosed ADHD, bipolar, Asperger's, anxiety, depression, you know, kind of gotten a DSM-4 diagnosis. And I got a wonderful review from a newspaper, and in the newspaper, the person wrote, I would love to see a fiction from this writer someday. And I remember thinking, fiction, what? But I just sort of tucked that away, you know, and years later, like after writing my memoir, when you write memoir, you know, all you do all day long is you've got to call everybody. Hey, I'm going to tell this story. Do you remember it like this? At least that's how I did it. I really wanted to make sure I honored all the people that were part of it. And it was kind of exhausting because, you know, it's a lot to wrap your, you're just wanting to really do it carefully and very thoughtfully because so many people could get upset or feel hurt, whatever. So I was like, wow, fiction. I mean, you could write about anything and like, no, but you know, anything, you no holds barred. And so that idea really fascinated me. And so like 4 years ago, I just started kind of opening my mind to that. And that was a little overwhelming at first. And I don't know if you experienced this as a fiction writer, but as soon as like, I can write about anything, it's like, it was just so explosive. My brain just went, woo, you know, and yeah. kind of, I had to like, limited. But what I did is I started to, and I worked with, I began to use journeying, so shamanic journeying. So I began to connect with the main character, with Mirror, in the spirit worlds where I could really like see her and ask her questions about what she wanted and how she would like the story to go and like how she would like it to be honored. And then of course I also worked with other people, like showing it to people and having them read the story. And like, I remember at one point my friend was like, she read the whole thing. She's like, well, she needs a love interest. I'm like, oh, duh. I know there was something missing. But, you know, when you've been married 30 years, you're like, you know, it just wasn't like I wasn't thinking about that. I was like, of course, that's what she needs. So that was the process. And I just got to incorporate a lot of things that I guess I really wanted the story to speak to people who maybe were experiencing some kind of massive plot twist that was unexpected and unpleasant in their life, in hopes that maybe they would, you know, see things in a different light. And I guess also through my extensive experience with ceremony, sacred ceremony, and sort of this idea that life is a ceremony, you know, I kind of wanted to play with that a little bit, which I do in the book. And also just get at some themes, like 3 of our 4 children are adopted. And so I've spent quite a bit of time reading and interacting with kids who are adopted, not just my own, but, you know, other kids through different experiences and learning about different things. And so I have a lot of, respect for the adoption triad and the trauma and the just, when I hear your sister's story, oh, that's just heartbreaking. And I just pray that she gets what she needs wherever she is, you know, and finds what she needs to find. because it's pretty, I remember when we were first adopting our first child, one of the social workers handed us some paper. It was called like the, I can't remember what it was, something like the basis of the psychological paper was like, this is like the deepest wound you could ever, I mean, you're going to adopt this child and they already have this incredible wound, like before, from the get-go. And I remember being like, I can't read that, put it away. Like, because I was just at such a place being, you know, it was just too hard for me to manage. Like, I could not even fathom that like a small baby would have already gone through something like that. But I hope that we're dealing with that more. I think we're doing better about that as a society. We're much more aware of trauma and what that does, you know?
Yeah, certainly when my sister was adopted, I mean, she's a year older than me. And as I've already mentioned, I'm about to turn 49, so she's about to turn 50. So it was a long time ago that she was adopted. And now we have a much deeper understanding, I think, of trauma, as you say, and especially since so many people have been going through trauma in the recent years and how traumatic all the events that have been happening have been. So there's a much deeper appreciation for it. But back at the, you know, when my parents adopted her, you know, there was no discussion of this kind of thing, and or even guides for how to adopt a child that comes from a different culture and might have a different skin color than you. That, you know, my parents, as kind of liberals coming from Berkeley, California, you know, thought, well, we could take in anyone and it'll all be fine. Right. And that, you know, looking back, maybe there were steps that could have been taken to help even address that there probably is a wound there, but you know, it never came up, but then the wound festered. I mean, it definitely festered within her around these feelings of, how could someone give me up? And then what is my place in this society where people don't necessarily look like me or expect certain things of me based on the way that I look? I mean, there's so much healing that my sister could do. And, you know, I see a lot of these things sort of reflected in Mira and in the dynamic with her mom. You know, I've known a few kids who call their parents by their first name, but it's always kind of shocking when somebody does that, right? But Mira constantly refers to her mom by her first name. So
yeah.
I'm curious, you know, in your own experience with adoption, is that what you use to kind of create this dynamic between Mira and her mom, or were you extrapolating, or does that, it's such a central piece of the book, so I'm curious of it.
Yeah, it really comes from my own experience with my mom, my own mom, who just died last year, and who got a chance to read the book and gave me her seal of approval, which was really sweet. So when I was a teen, I had a really tough relationship with her. I mean, we were just, you know, really struggled. And through the years and through lots of both of us working on it and through ceremony and other things, we healed. And it was so wonderful. But I guess I wanted to, show that struggle, that it's okay. Like, you know, it can be normal. I mean, I know some people get along swimmingly with their mom in the teen years, but I was not one of them. You know, I thrashed and but at the same time, I really wanted, deep down, I wanted my mom and I to have a better relationship. And I could see that other mothers and daughters did. And I wanted that so badly. And I just wasn't able to manifest that until later in life. And that's okay. You know, that was just how it was. So that really comes from my own experience. And then some of the things that happen with Mira are things taken from other, you know, meeting other people that I've learned, because I've met a lot of adoptees and moms who've placed their children for adoption and all these things. And so I just have so much respect for that, all the pain and all the beauty and all the trust and all the, you know, that goes into that, you know, a child being placed for adoption. One of our kids, our youngest, was able, he's the only one who's wanted to search so far, but he was able to meet both his birth mother and his birth father in Guatemala. That was, gosh, it's going on like 6-5 years ago. It's been a while now, but that was a pretty profound and extremely moving experience to meet them and what amazing people they are. And and yet it's very complicated. I mean, it's really hard for a kid to understand, no matter what you tell them, you know, this is, they had to do this because they were under extreme duress, you know, financially and otherwise. Yeah, and I pray that I got it right enough. I'll be curious to see. I hope that, you know, people who read the book feel that I sensitively handled all the topics.
Yeah.
I did my best.
Yeah, and there certainly are a number of them in there. And just something I wanted to go back to is that you mentioned kind of journeying with Mira kind of in the shamanic space. And I think it's... I always love talking to other novelists to kind of hear like, well, where is your real life influencing what you're writing about in the novel? And generally when you talk to novelists, you find, well, there's a lot of autobiographical stuff that's in there in one way or another. But then the characters themselves, when you really focus on your characters, that I've found as a writer, that they really take on a life of their own, and they have their own needs and their own demands and their own expectations. And so as a writer, you do get into this weird kind of relationship where you might even think, well, I want this story to go this way. And the characters are like, nope, no, we're going this way. And it can be surprising even for the person writing it. So I'm just curious about your overall experience of writing the book. You know, I know some people like to sit down and map out their novels and here's all the plot points I'm going to hit and this is where it's going to resolve. I'm just curious what that experience was like for you, sort of overall, how you would characterize it.
Yeah, I did sit down and attempt to map it out using a book called, it's like the Snowflake Method or something for writing novels. Because I was like, this thing has to have a structure. I mean, you realize a good story has to have these, like, you know, these turning points and these, you know, and I knew nothing about it. So I kind of put myself to school reading tons of books about it. And I loved this one book. So anyway, I tried to outline it. But what happens is, for all my books, really, I've worked with my helping spirits. Like, I have a particular helping spirit in the upper world who I go to when I'm going to start writing a book or when I'm struggling with a book and it's not working. And, you know, they'll often give me advice or just tell me something that helps me, you know, to understand, like, maybe it's confusing at first, but then starts to make sense and it gets me going. This book was really hard and I gave up on it a couple times. The first time I gave up on it, I was like, I just don't know. I just don't think I can really do this. I want to do it well, you know. And I remember they took this group to Thailand. We were on this pachydermal pilgrimage visiting all these elephants in Thailand and partying down. And the woman that I was co-leading the trip with, she started telling me about her sister. And she told me something about her sister that is very rare and something very unusual that is exactly what, you know, a part of what the novel already was about. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this woman who I'm spending 2 weeks with in Thailand, her sister, I could talk with her sister. Her sister could help me. And that's when I realized, okay, I got to go back to this book. The book wants to be written. The book wants to be written, you know? And then I gave up on it again. Just like, I can't do this. It's too hard and it's not working. And again, I'm like in the basement of SeaTac Airport in Seattle at like in the parking garage. And there's this person that's struggling with something. And I'm like, oh, can I help you? And we ended up striking up this conversation. And she starts to tell me something that is, again, like, it's just like a one in a billion chance. Like, we're having this conversation and it's all has something to do with the book. And I'm just like, okay. It's like, and I just knew, like, you have to have the courage to go back and finish this, Sarah. You know, it wants to be written. The story wants to be written. And I think that's that character. And then I felt that more and more as I got more connected to Mira. It's like, I can see her. I can feel her. I can touch her hair and know exactly how it feels. And I like love her like a daughter, you know, in a strange way. I mean, I know she's not, you know, she's not here on Earth, but it's just, yeah. And it's so fun. Like, that's what I realized when I've heard people talk about, like, when they're in a movie and they're acting out an actor and they can't, you know, they're playing a role and they can't let it go. Like, I've heard of these actors where, like, they just are that person for the month or whatever, that they're whatever, Robert De Niro, or whatever. And it's like, friends are like, dude, I can't have lunch with you right now because you are being the thing and it's not you. I don't know where you went. But I can see how that would happen because you just begin to fully embody it. And it just makes life so fascinating because your whole life becomes this adventure. Like, what is the plot twist? Where is the book taking me? Because I don't know. And you just wake up and see where it's going. But things like that kept happening. And I was like, okay, this is like a spirit book. It wants to be written and it wants to come out.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting that when writing fiction, I personally find it much more of a process of embracing the unknown than it is with writing a fiction book. Because, you know, with a fiction book, this is what I want to say. This is how I'm going to say it. But, you know, with the novels, there's always these open-ended questions of, well, what are going to be the plot twists? How is this character going to grow or respond or fail? And, you know, where is it all going? So there's always a lot of uncertainty. So for me, it's a very different process of writing a novel than writing a fiction book. So I don't want to give away any plot spoilers, but I'm just curious about the disease that shows up in the book, if there was a particular inspiration for that, or did you have to do a lot of research around that?
Yes, I did do a lot of research, and I had personally had a close encounter, we'll say. Like, I had had something very similar happen to me. And so I got, like, what I would say is like a Baskin-Robbins type spoon taste of a little bit of that. And so that was part of the inspiration. It's just like, you know, that was part of why I chose, you know, that or made that choice. And again, this idea that, and I think of this ceremonially, but also in life, you know, sometimes the more challenging ceremonies are sometimes the most beautiful ones where we learn the most, you know. My friends, she's got this wise woman called Helen who advises her. And she says, Helen says, we never learn anything in the good times. And I think there's some truth to that. Not that we wish bad times on ourselves or anyone. Of course, we don't. But it is those challenging and mysterious experiences that take some time to understand. Yeah, that I think really are, what I want to say, galvanizing or something like that. I heard a story, you know, because the book does obviously involve some psychedelics. I read a story once on Reddit, which also inspired part of the book. This guy in this Reddit thread, they were talking about bad trips. Mm-hmm. And this guy said, I saw the devil and it was insane. This was like, literally, I saw the devil and it was so evil and it was so dark and it was so horrible. I will never, ever, ever, ever do this again. Like, warning, warning, never do this. You know, he was just, and he said, as soon as that happened to me, you know, like, I went back to my, I moved back home. I cut my hair and I got a girlfriend and I got a job. And I was thinking, like, I just laughed because I was like, interesting. Anyway, I guess I'll just leave that there.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't want to give away spoilers, but so as you mentioned, that there is psychedelic healing that's involved in the book, and it comes towards the end of the book. So it's not like, it's not a book that is based around the idea of psychedelic healing. It's not the main theme in any way, but it's definitely a very important role within the book. And the decisions that Mira is going through about how to trust herself, trust her intuition, trust what feels right for her, even if, you know, she's getting pushback from her mom and wondering about, well, what are other people going to think of me? I mean, I think it comes really beautifully as an 18-year-old girl who's trying to decide what is she going to do for herself, especially faced with the medical reality that she has within the book and kind of the monkey wrench that throws into her whole life plan that she's already has established for herself of what she wants to do. And now this medical condition arises. And, you know, as a reader of the book, knowing that psychedelic healing was coming in the book, I found myself thinking all the way through, like, oh, I hope it's a realistic healing. That was my thought going through, because there can be the potential to, because, you know, sometimes it does happen where someone has some kind of issue and then they go and they have their psychedelic journey and they come out and it's like, oh, everything's all better. Look at that. And I was hoping again, I don't want to give away spoilers, but I was hoping, well, I hope it's really realistic what she goes mm-hmm. through. And I think that you've done a good job with that. And I think it's kind of a daring choice to be writing a young adult fiction coming of age novel and making the decision that it's going to culminate in some psychedelic experience and psychedelic healing. So I'm just curious to hear how you made that decision.
Yeah, you know, I think it was, I was reading at the time, this is like 4 or 5 years ago, I was reading all this young YA fiction. It was kind of the height of that. You know, YA was really big at the time, and I was reading like John Green, and he went to my same college I did. And I was like, oh my God, these books are so fun. Because, you know, you kind of get re-immersed in being in high school again, and it was kind of a delicious, and I was like, these are fun. They're short. They don't need to be this like the novel of the, you know, it doesn't have to be a waffle iron. Like I could just really, maybe I could write something fun like this, you know, something. I mean, obviously I'm not trying to compare myself to John Green, but that was really what got me interested in the genre. And then unfortunately, when I wrote the book, my agent was like, you know, they were like, we could never publish this under YA because of the nature of the topic, the psychedelics involved. So I did make her 18, and then I just decided, well, I'm just going to publish it. I'll just self-publish. And I think it's a book, too, that you don't need to be a young adult to read it. It's like many people have told me, you know, it's a story for any age who's interested. I guess you'd have to be interested in young people, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I would agree as well. I mean, as a parent, I can relate to a lot of things in the book, and also having... I was a young person myself once, and I wanted to make different decisions for myself than my parents wanted me to make. And as I said, you know, it brought up my own issues and ideas around my own sister. And I also am someone who has a chronic and debilitating medical condition that I'm currently living with. And so there's a lot of things that I found that I can really relate. And yeah, I mean, it was interesting that I was thinking, like, okay, well, it's a young adult novel. It's not something I would normally read. But I, you know, I just sat down and I read it over a couple of days, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought all the, as I've said, the dynamics between the mother and daughter, it all just felt very realistic. And kind of the, especially the both sides of it, kind of getting the mom wanting to be protective, wanting to do the best for her child, but then not having it received that way by the child. And then the slowly blossoming self-awareness of, oh, maybe I've kind of been a jerk. Maybe mom really was doing her best for me. Not that it's just a blanket, whatever your parents do is great, but you know, just that dynamic. So I think that there's something that's very relatable for a lot of people. And then I think it's exciting that it does get into psychedelic healing because, you know, this is coming. Here in Oregon, you know, we've legalized psilocybin therapy, and, you know, that's in the development stages right now. But this is going to be part of the landscape, the normal, socially integrated landscape. And it's not necessarily going to involve a trip to Mexico or a trip to South America, though it's probably will. You know, that's still going to be around. But this is part of the changing mental health care landscape that we're living in. And so in that sense, your book is actually cutting edge because it's talking about these things that are currently happening. These are the changes that are being made. And eventually, I think it will be accessible to someone who's probably 18 years old. I think that will probably be the limit. In some cases, it might be 21. But certainly, young people... they're in much of need of healing as anybody else. So I think it's, again, I'm just kind of struck by the realism of it and felt that you captured it very well. And even though it's sort of risky to put in a psychedelic healing that takes place, that I really feel that you dealt with it well and sort of showed both the challenge and also the beauty that can come from these kinds of experiences. And I don't think this is too much of a spoiler. It's not a quote unquote literal healing that takes place. It's something deeper than that.
Oh, and I really want to honor the people who, you know, have been championing in these healings, you know, for these hundreds, maybe thousands of years. You know, I really wanted to call attention to the beautiful way people have been doing this work quietly forever without any kind of FDA or money making, or, you know what I mean? I think that that's my one concern about all what's happening right now. It's so exciting, but then all of a sudden I just think, oh gosh, yeah, when it becomes the purview of the clinician's office and the, you know, I don't know. We'll see how that goes. Only time will tell, as they say, right?
Yeah. I mean, definitely we're at the point of change, and it kind of remains to be seen how is this all going to develop. You know, here in Oregon, they're trying to make the program, in a sense, as diverse as possible. So it's not just going to be one model, one mode that, you know, it could even involve, you know, the rules haven't all been made yet. So it's all in the development period, but it might be possible to do like a nature healing walk up on Mount Ashland and using psilocybin, and as long as there are guides and people there to take care of you, that might be as much of the program as going into a clinic and getting a session and therapy there. But, you know, still it remains to be seen how it's all really going to develop. But we're definitely on the precipice. Some people like to share these things, others don't. So I would just invite you, you know, with the psychedelic healing that takes place in the book, are you speaking from personal experience, or is this an area that, you know, you'd rather not talk about? It's okay.
No, I am. I am definitely speaking from experience. Yep. Yeah. And I got a chance to, you know, assist, a healer who trained in that tradition in the Mazateca Mountains and, who's a very powerful, amazing woman. And so some of these things come out of that experience of, you know, watching her work and in some small way trying to be of assistance to her, but I was mostly watching her work. And my own personal experiences as well with challenging ceremonies and the outcomes of those.
Yeah. And with that own entry into your own life, was that for you, you know, for some people, it's like, oh, yeah, I did that. But others, it was like a big step to say, well, I went and I did something like that. Kind of like with Mira in the book. This is not something that was even in her field, you know, thinking about how to deal with her medical condition. And then this sort of gets presented through her aunt. And sort of, so a big leap for her, and she has a lot of doubts about it along the way. And I don't want to give it to spoilers, but she does want to run away. She does, you know, after her first ceremony, I don't know about that. But she sticks it out. So I'm just curious how you felt about it, that entry into your own life. And, you know, did it come after starting sort of the drumming shamanic method, or was this something you'd been exposed to earlier and then came back to, you know?
Yeah, actually in college, I did take one dose of, psilocybin, like just on a whim. It was like our senior week of graduating or something like that. And it was sort of like one of these, whoa, like I really didn't have, it wasn't a bad experience. It wasn't a good experience. It was just kind of a strange experience. Yeah. Didn't really give it much thought. And then I stumbled onto the shamanic path, and then I did decided to go into, you know, a 3-year training with Foundation for Shamanic Studies. And for 4 or 5, you know, I would say 5 or 6 years, maybe I was fully immersed in that world for at least 5 years. And Michael Harner, who's, you know, the guy who wrote The Way of the Shaman, his thought was, he had traveled all over the world and met with many shamans and worked with them. And he felt like in all these different places he went to visit that the A-team typically was not using plant medicines. That was his take. And that was sort of his wisdom that he passed down to us. So I was always like, okay. He's like, the drama's great. It's just powerful. Just stick, you know. He didn't tell us not to, but he was like, and I bought that. I was like, that's okay. And then I had an opportunity to spend time in Peru, and through this, you know, it's a long story, but anyway, I ended up really liking this person and really trusting them and thinking, and they were like, well, we're doing a plant medicine ceremony. Would you like to join us? And I was like, yes, I would. And that was a ceremony with Huachuma, or San Pedro.
Yeah.
And it was such a beautiful, and it was beautiful. It was done out in nature, and it was such a powerful and moving experience. And I learned so much that day about how to live and how I wanted to live. And it really just changed my life. I mean, I just have nothing but gratitude for that medicine. And that's really what made me realize, well, I don't know, Michael Herner has his own experience and that's okay. But I just gained something really tremendous and really special. And so I think that's what opened my heart to these things. And yeah, so I've had quite a bit of experience with, you know, Huachuma and ayahuasca. And then eventually, through actually curiosity, walking on, stumbling on the boreal trails around here in Duluth, I began working. This is how I met that the teacher was, I began working with Amanita. It was really just speaking to me. It was just drawn to me. I was like, I don't know why, but it just kind of picked me to talk to it. And I was like, what would you like? And was like, I want to work with you. And I'm like, okay. But I mean, you know, this is a poisonous mushroom allegedly and all these things. And so I sought out a teacher, and this woman showed me how to make a tea with that. And, you know, very like a lot, nothing, you know, you're not eating giant quantities of these things, but, and that also was a very profound and, gentle, thankfully gentle medicine that I've worked with for years. And so anyway, that was how I met her. And eventually I started going to some of her ceremonies and helping her out a little bit. And, yeah. And I thought twice about, you know, including all this and writing this book, because I think there's so many ways for people to find their way, and it doesn't have to be this way. But on the other hand, it's helped me a lot. So I have a lot of gratitude.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great to go ahead and dive into it. You know, it's a little bit safe in the form of fiction. But yeah. Thank you for sharing with us that, you know, that these are plants and medicines that you yourself have worked with, and you're not just approaching it, you know, from say a literary perspective, but actually a personal perspective. And it is interesting how these divides sort of come up, that, you know, with Michael Herner and sort of saying, yeah, you don't really need the plants. And as you say, the A-team is just doing the drumming. And, you know, I experienced, you know, I have my PhD in religious studies, and I did my field work at the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico. And their tradition itself does not use visionary plants and cacti and things like that. And one of the medicine men that I lived and worked with, he had only sat in a peyote ceremony. He didn't actually ever eat any peyote. And he said, oh yeah, that's just all the make-believe religion. And then I could go talk to the medicine people who were working with peyote, and they would say, no, this is the real deal. And everything else is just a show that other people are doing. And so even within this one culture, there is these very clear divides between those who used and respected the plant medicines and those who didn't want anything to do with it. And, you know, different judgments going both ways. But I think, and then, you know, with this medicine man who I really loved and respected, that I always felt like, wow, well, you should at least give it a try before you make an assessment about which is the make-believe religion.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's everyone's choice whether they want to jump into that or not.
And there's so much potential for abuse. I think that's, you know, something that should give everybody pause, you know, like to be really thoughtful about that, you know, with the medicines, because it does really obtain, you know, people can get very, you know, it alters your senses so massively that, you know, all kinds of things can you know, happen. So yes, caution with all things.
Yeah. So with Where the Deer Dream, certainly it feels like the book stands on its own. You can read it front to back and there's the story, but it also seems like there might be the potential for continuing the story of Mira.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious if you have thoughts or feelings about that, and maybe future novels that might include some of these other medicines and these other modalities for healing?
Yeah, I really, I guess I'm just going to see what happens, but I have a lot of ideas for what might happen to Mira as she progresses along. So yeah, we'll see. But if there's an audience for it, I'm up for it.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, anything else you just want to tell us about what's going on and what's available? I guess maybe we could talk just for a minute about your website and what you're offering and where people can find you and what you have here, like all these great books. Again, Born to Freak, How Good Are You Willing to Let It Get, The Book of Beasties, Swimming with Elephants. Oh, and I didn't ask you, did you swim with elephants?
In a journey. So yeah, that's sort of alluding to that. Yes. What do I want to tell people what's going on? Well, if you're a person who wants to write a book, a friend and I, another fellow author and I have cooked up a program where we're going to we want anybody who's really determined to write their book in 2022 to join us. And if people want to go to that, they could either email me or it may be on the front of my website, but I think it's Inger Kenobi if you go to ingerkenobi.com, you'll find it because it's at my fellow writers' site. And we're going to do a 4-month kind of intensive like container to help support people to get it done, you know? So we're excited about that. And other than that, yeah, I'm doing my shamanic healing work and my coaching. And so I'm always, open to clients who, would like to heal something at the level of spirit. That's one of my things I do and I love.
Oh, and I just thought of one other thing I wanted to ask you about Where the Deer Dream. Because I've done a little bit of this in my own fiction as well. But Mira is reading the Book of Beasties.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering how you felt about making that decision of including your own nonfiction work within the fiction. Did you ever question that and I don't know if I should do that, or was it just natural that you wanted to include that in there?
Well, somebody else made the suggestion because they were like, this could just be a natural thing, and I was like, okay, let's try that. And I'm like, it's hard for me to get a feeling of how that feels. Somebody told me recently, she goes, I thought that was really like ballsy and really like, I loved it, but I mean, I'm sure just as many people might be irritated by it. I have no idea. But we were kind of like, and then it was really magical because once I made that decision, I went and wove in some other beasties and just quote, randomly went through the book. And it was so neat what kind of came out of it that it felt very spirit supported. So and that book is very, I opened a ceremony for that, to write that book. So it feels very like a gift from the spirit. So it makes sense that it's in there. Hopefully people will understand.
Well, great. Well, I thought it was a good reference and I thought it was a good use of bringing in something from your role of nonfiction into the fictional universe. And, I think it's worthwhile for your readers to know like, oh yeah, well, she wrote that book. Look at that. And that it's a real book, So it's kind of fun. I like crossing the lines between fiction and nonfiction because, it's all a story anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Oh. Well, anything else you feel that we haven't covered that you would like to share with the listeners before I let you go, Sarah?
Oh, I don't think so. This has just been such a delight, Martin. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
All right. Well, thanks for making time for me today. And just to remind everybody, we're talking about Where the Deer Dream, A Coming-of-Age Adventure in Spirit by Sarah Bamford Seidelman. And coming out, just a couple days before this podcast has been released. So at this point in the future, when this is released, it is available right now.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. And hope the winter is not too severe over there in Duluth. Yes,
thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Martin.
Okay.